This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we've got three sponsors for the show, the first being Jazz Software, who provide ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies, such as Macs, iPad, iPhone, and Apple TV in education. More about them at jazzsoftware.com. And Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect, and review student work and to provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, and more. And finally, Aerohive unleashes the power of enterprise mobility. Aerohive's technology enables organizations of all sizes to use mobility to increase productivity, engage customers, and grow their business. We'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. Bradley, how are you doing?
I'm good. I am knee-deep in Chrome OS deployment, but that's a story for another day.
That sounds like a whole show.
I mean, just from the highlights, it is taking the hardest part, the most time-consuming part of it is probably logging in the first time because I don't know, my password is very long. So what I should have done is like made my administrator password extremely short and turned off two-factor authentication, and then it would be a lot faster process. But it's, yeah, going well. It takes these are easy to install. It takes about six screws to... And these are the Chrome bases, so it's like the all-in-one monitor, kind of like the iMac ripoff, and you have to mount the base to the monitor. It takes about six screws. Good to go. Comes with mouse and keyboard, plug into wired Ethernet because these locations are stationary. And once you log in, it dumps them into my kind of general groupings. So you move your devices into like organizations like you do your other, like you do your users. Like we have just various organizations inside of our organization. And then they get a policy pulled down, and kind of simple. Yeah, pretty happy so far. But yeah, that'll be a longer story for another day.
Okay, look forward to hearing it. Yeah, big week. We got plenty to talk about. Lots to talk about today. WWDC, we're recording this on Wednesday, so it's 2 days after the keynote. And obviously there will be some sessions today. Well, sort of now, I guess. It's Wednesday evening UK time we're recording this. We've seen a couple of things from WWDC from the other sessions, and obviously the keynote was public on Monday, so we're going to cover that, and I'll talk a little bit about session 301, which was the session about deployment. There's some interesting stuff in there as well. These sessions are visible online, so you can go and watch them yourself as well, and I recommend that you do that. But we have some notes and some perspective on the show that I thought everybody would quite like to hear, so shall we just get right into it?
Yeah, and one tip for everybody, if you are downloading the sessions, if you're like on your Mac, if you hold the option button when you click fast forward, you can speed up the playback.
Ah.
And there's a bug in Yosemite that does cause the audio to drop off once you hit 2x. I'm not sure why that is, but yeah, so you can go to like 1.9 and then you kind of got to stop. But yeah, you can speed up the playback, which is really helpful for kind of rewatching the sessions, if you just kind of want to see what they're saying again. It's kind of like 2x playback on a podcast app. But yeah, works in QuickTime on the Mac.
Okay, good tip. I've been watching them on the WWDC app, which you can download from the App Store, which you also don't need to have a developer login to watch the videos. I'm pretty sure, is that right?
No, you do not.
Yeah. So those videos are public information, so there's nothing that we're telling you that you can't find out for yourself. We just want to highlight some of those things this week.
Yes.
So the keynote, right?
I mean, it was. This is always a fun one because you kind of do. You like the fall ones are about hardware, and this is you get more of a vision of where the ecosystem is going. So that's kind of one of the reasons I always like this one the best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also you get most of what's on stage for free, right?
I thought about that. That it's like nothing here is going to cost you any money.
Yeah. Yeah. It's. I think we should probably start off by saying that out of respect for the memory of Steve Jobs and his family, we'll just pretend that the Apple Music announcement never happened.
Is that okay? Yes, that's fine. I'll subscribe, but yeah, it was awkward. Of course, it probably isn't up yet, but the Phil Schiller on the live version of the talk show was pretty exciting as well.
We should probably comment on that once we've had a chance to listen to it in full. All I've done is I've heard what people said.
I heard most of it. Yeah. I caught most of it. Because it's like middle of the night when you're in, because it was, I think it was like, it was on at like 11 o'clock my time. So you were like way asleep.
I'm not staying up to 4 a.m. for John Gruber, no matter what. Let's talk about the keynote first. Obviously, there was information about iOS and OS X. What do you think about El Capitan as a name?
I think it'll... Well, here's the thing. I have heard people not pronounce Yosemite right. I had someone tell me, hey, I upgraded to the new Yosemite.
Yeah.
And it's like, so I think it'll probably be mispronounced and people are going to like, I don't know. It's fine. I don't get too hung up on it because I think since they're not paid anymore, people just upgrade to the latest one and may not ever even remember.
Yeah, I guess the names don't have to sell the product quite as much as they maybe used to in the past. I mean, from my point of view, as somebody who's not American, if they could make Mavericks work, I mean, I thought that sucked as a name when I first heard it. It's like, I'd never heard of Mavericks before until it was the Apple name. Yosemite, okay, plenty of people know about that. El Capitan, I don't know if many people know that that's a mountain inside Yosemite or not, but at least outside of the US, but I guess it's one of these situations where whatever Apple says the name is, that people are going to just deal. So, yeah, I don't particularly care.
Yeah, it is what it is. I mean, I think it's, I'm trying to think of a good example. I mean, I think, I don't care about those places, but because I don't live there, but they make them and they care about those places and that's fine.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
So, yeah, lots of new things. We didn't see like the range of just like, 1,000 new features like we had in years past, but it was like key stuff. Like it was stuff like, it was really tightening the belt on hitting some of the low hanging fruit. And then you kind of get a vision for where things are going in the future, particularly on the iPad. And good keynote. I'm very happy overall with what we saw. Mm-hmm. And I am not running the betas at this point.
Well, I've got iOS 9 on my iPad, but not on my phone. And I don't have El Capitan on my Mac yet. I kind of felt like, last year was very much a kind of, you know, you asked for it, we did it. You asked for it, we did it kind of thing. And they were just hitting home all the time. You know, you wanted extensions, we did it. You wanted keyboards, we've done it, and so on. Whereas this year, there was a couple of things that we sort of, I don't know that we even wanted as much as kind of expected to happen. And then there's a number of things that I don't know that I heard that many people saying, oh, we really need to have this. But Apple went ahead and did it anyway. Obviously, smaller iOS updates is one thing that was announced, which that is one thing that everybody said that has got to get fixed. So they're talking about it being down to like 1.3 gigs of free space in order to do an over-the-air update. That's clearly a strategic problem for Apple because you can tell that the iOS 8 adoption rate is much, and it's not, probably not by this point much less, but it certainly was substantially slower than it was in years past. So that's going to be good. Never really a big problem for us, Bradley. I don't know about you, but we never had a problem with that because we were running 32 gig devices and the vast majority of them are not close to being full.
Yeah, I think this is like a problem aimed at people who have the 16 gig phones.
Yeah.
Now, this problem, the 4 gigs wouldn't have been as bad had... Like, I don't think this go around with going to iOS 9 if people had iCloud Photo Library turned on and they had the Optimize on. Because they theoretically, most likely photos were eating up the most people's space. And so it could kind of hopefully help better manage that. But yeah, I think that's great. I think I don't think, like, if you can't get down to that, then I don't think there's much you could get down to. I mean, that's something, that, unless you literally have like 300 megs for free. But again, these are people with too many photos that need to turn on iCloud Photo Library.
Yeah. I just hope that people don't look at this and think, oh, that means it's okay to get 16 gig devices next time. I would really strongly encourage people still to stick to minimum 32 for one-to-one school deployments at least.
Yeah, I agree. 32 gigs still are recommended. Phil Schiller was asked about that last night by John Gruber about why they still sell 16 gig devices. And he said that we've done the research and like and his point was like people get by with it. It helps us save money to enhance. Say his example was like, we can spend less money on storage. We can spend it on a better camera for the device. And then he mentioned iCloud. And again, like iCloud would be a great reason or a great excuse if it wasn't 5 gigs free. I mean, so you kind of you can't have both in my opinion, but
yeah, he called them the most cost-conscious consumers, didn't he? And those are the people he's expecting to sign up for a monthly paid cloud plan. Okay. So improvements in battery life. They talked about 1 hour longer runtime on an iPhone. Didn't mention iPad stats in that section. And there's a power reserve mode for iOS now, kind of like the watch has got a power reserve mode. They said that you could get 3 hours extra out of it. But somebody on Twitter talked to me about that, and they said that that's 3 hours if you turn it on when the device is at 100%. So if you say you're running down to 20% and you turn on power reserve, you're not going to get another 3 hours out of 20% of the battery. You're going to get another, you know, hour maybe. But even an hour in the school context is a not irrelevant amount of time. So that'll be welcome as well.
I think one of the things will be interesting to see is like could possibly, in the, I don't think it'll happen this year, but maybe next year, could you set a like set this via MDM where when the device get down to say 30% or 40%, could you enforce this?
Yeah, just automatically trigger it at some point. I mean, it could be a bit like do not disturb, you know, just start stretching it out once it gets down that low. Yeah.
Yeah, because again, if you did it at 40%, then you probably could be assured you'd make it through the day, because if it's that could possibly maybe give you another hour and a half, 2 hours. I don't know. But yeah, be nice to, you know, the more things we can control automatically and via MDM, I'm all on board for.
I mean, I still think that the strongest thing that Apple could do to help schools with battery life is to allow us to enforce a maximum 60% brightness on the device, because that is the reason why kids run out of batteries, because they just turn the brightness up to 100%. So yeah, battery life improvements, all good. Next thing I wanted to mention, Bradley, was this thing called App Secure Transport, which is something, this is one of these things that I think nobody was sort of really asking for or expecting, but you can see kind of why they would go ahead and do it. And App Secure Transport is basically what they're saying is that all of the URL libraries in iOS and OS X are going to go encrypted by default, HTTPS by default, so that if you need to talk to a back-end server without using encryption, you have to ask for an exception to that in your app's info plist, which is a document that is built into your app that tells Apple and the store and the system various things, properties about your app. So developers are going to have to request exemptions to using encryption. And I think that has interesting implications for school filtering, because overall, a lot of school filtering, a lot of the interception filtering that happens on networks sort of depends on you not using HTTPS. And I don't know if you've visited schools, Bradley, I have, that require everybody to install an additional root certificate on their device so that they can do a man-in-the-middle attack on them as their traffic is going out of the school network. And my experience almost universally with that has been a massive hit on performance of the network. I talked to some people about that, and they were telling me that, okay, yeah, you can get devices with, you know, dedicated hardware for decrypting and re-encrypting SSL, but the problem is, you know, those things are like $15,000 and only enterprises have them, and don't think schools are really prepared for the amount of computing power they're going to need to do that kind of analysis on all the traffic if it goes HTTPS only.
Yeah, and what's your end game there? I mean, how do you really want to spend that kind of money and put in that much effort just to be able to see what every person is doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's an open question. I think that the answer to that is actually a policy level question. Is it what are the expectations of parents, government, school inspectors, of your protection online? Now, of course, there are other ways that you can do this. And one of the interesting things in iOS 9 is that there are now new extension points for Safari, which will allow another app, a third-party app, to provide Safari with blocking rules as to what kind of content should be blocked. And it's kind of interesting because I feel like we're almost about to come full circle with filtering, whereas, you know, if you remember, like in the 90s, people used to install, you know, was it Parent Guardian or something on their PC, and the filtering would be done on the computer because you only had one computer. And then because we got so many computers, we went to filtering at the level of the network. And now that our devices have gone mobile, filtering any particular network is no good anymore because devices can freely move between so many different networks. And I think we're about to go back to a world where we implement filtering on the device rather than a network level, because now we've got so many networks as well that we have to do it on the device. So I think that's the end game, to be honest with you, Bradley.
And one thing to remember is like DNS and like domain name-based filtering is still fine here.
Yes.
This is like, you know, content inspection kind of thing.
Yeah, if you're doing content analysis on every page and every image that goes past your proxy, then you're going to have a difficult time with this. But if you're doing, you know, OpenDNS or whatever, that should still be as effective as it is right now. I mean, it's not as watertight as other kinds of filtering, but it is at least going to remain effective in the face of this architectural change that Apple's kind of leading here.
So before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night, the fine folks at Aerohive Networks. Now, Aerohive unleashes the power of enterprise mobility. Their technology enables organizations of all sizes to use mobility to increase productivity, engage customers, engage students, and grow their businesses. It's deployed in over now 22,000 enterprises. I got new update there. So it's over 22,000 enterprises worldwide. Aerohive's proprietary mobility platform takes advantage of the cloud and a distributed architecture to deliver unified, intelligent, and cost-effective networks. So if you want to learn more about Aerohive Networks and their wired and wireless solutions, visit aerohive.com, AeroHive.com. Thanks to Aerohive for sponsoring the show. So what's next? So I guess the next thing would be the iPad multitasking, which we all assumed this would come this year because it was, you could see the remnants of it in Xcode last year.
Yeah, and this has kind of been rumored since forever, right? But I think to me, Bradley, this is the star of the show, well, at least for us iPad deployers and users. I think this is one of the things that it sets a new direction. It's the first kind of new thing that we've seen for iPad in a long time. And you know what I've talked before on the show about, I want to see some kind of statement of intent from Apple about what the iPad is going to become. And I really feel like this is the first thing we've seen in quite a long time, really since, I would argue, since iMovie came out for iOS, or maybe iPhoto. And I think just to kind of give an update for people who maybe haven't watched the keynote, there's three different kinds of multitasking that are possible in iOS 9 with a relatively modern iPad, and we'll talk about that in a second. The first one is picture-in-picture video. Now, this is quite straightforward in that basically whenever you're watching a video, you've watched, you know, videos on the web or YouTube or Netflix or whatever, when you close the app, the video stops. Right? What happens now is if you're using the standard iOS video player, there's an additional little control in the corner which you can tap, and the video pops out from where it is and it goes into an overlay view, very much like the front camera view when you're in a FaceTime call, and you can expand and shrink that window. You can switch away from the app you were running, so you can close Safari and go back to the home screen, and this little window will persist. And it will move around the screen. It will avoid the dock on the home screen, and it will avoid a toolbar if you go into another window. You can shrink it down very small, and you can actually flick it so that only the edge is showing and the rest of the video is off the screen. And I think that's going to be very useful for a lot of things. I talked to some kids at school about it, and to a man and woman, every single one of them said, "That's amazing. You can now listen to music on YouTube while you do your work." So I think this feature has a major implication for school networks if apps like YouTube and Netflix do adopt this feature, that kids could be working on, you know, whatever it is, and also streaming YouTube video in the background. So I think overall, you know, we've just mentioned Aerohive, whatever enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system you've got, one of the things you're going to really need is to be able to keep an eye on how much traffic people are sending to services like YouTube and Netflix. I think that could be an interesting little time for us over the next couple of years.
Yeah. What you might expect from the average device might go up slightly. In terms of bandwidth, on a given day.
Yeah, it remains to be seen. The thing is, the way it works is that it's built in for apps that use the system video player. But I'm not totally convinced that either YouTube or Netflix actually use the system video player. In fact, I'm 99% certain they don't. So it's going to be interesting to see if those apps can implement this as well, or even if they want to. They might not want to. So that's kind of the most basic form of multitasking, is multitasking for videos. The second one is a thing called slide over. And slide over, what you do is you pull in from the right-hand edge. And what happens is you get an app picker, which is basically a vertical scrolling list of apps. You pick one, and that app will launch in effectively about one-third of the width of your iPad screen, if you're looking at it in landscape. And that's this is a real app, right? It's not like, you know, iOS 7 multitasking where you're looking at a frozen screenshot of an app that was in the background. This is actually a live app sliding in over the top of another app. The currently active app gets darkened, so you're only working with this one app. But what you're being given is you're being given the iPhone interface version. So you can see even an app that when you launch it in full screen, it would show a different interface. Say you launch Safari in slide over, you get the iPhone version of Safari rather than the iPad version. But it's very effective for just pulling in an app to look at something and then getting rid of it again if you want to work in full screen. That's slide over. At the moment, what I can see on iOS 9 is that only the built-in apps support this. So I think what's got to happen is apps have got to declare their support for this in some way. No third-party app is available to be launched in the slide-over window at all. So that's going to be an update that has to come. I think what's really obvious, Bradley, is that non-universal apps are in real trouble with this feature. Because if you don't have an iPhone version in your iPad app, then the app that's installed on the iPad is not going to be able to show up in that little view. So you think about OmniFocus, for example, which has only just gone universal. In previous times, when you had the iPad-only app for OmniFocus, it's not clear to me how that would have shrunk down into that small space, whereas now with the universal OmniFocus, we can have it full screen as an iPad app, or the iPhone version of it can show up in that sidebar. That's going to be really cool.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. And again, as you like, we had this big transition to iOS 7, but it was a lot of visual things. Like every year, as the platform gets matured, these apps that are not staying up to date stand out more and more.
Yeah, and this is going to be another opportunity for if your app does not participate in multitasking like this, your app is going to get replaced in pretty short order. So that's something that people are going to have to keep up with. If people have been reading the tea leaves from Apple over the past few WWDCs, this much should be obvious, right? And I think if you look at what Omni have done, for example, with their apps, they've taken them all from iPad only to universal apps. And that, and for most apps, that's meant bringing them to the phone for the first time, such as Omni Graffle and Omni Plan. But for Omni Focus, that was a case of taking the iPhone app and turning it into a universal app. So that's slide over, right? Now, those two features, right, picture-in-picture video and slide-over, those are available on any A7 class processor or later, right? So specifically what we mean by that is the iPad Air or Air 2 and the iPad Mini 2 or 3. None of this is available at all for anything running an A5 or an A6 processor. So no iPad Mini 1s, no third or fourth generation Retina display iPads, and certainly no iPad 2, okay? And I'm guessing that's primarily RAM and performance for those ones. But then we've got this third category of multitasking, which is called split screen. And what happens is and this is only on an iPad Air 2, you can, once you've pulled in an app in slide over, you can actually tap the little divider. And what happens is that the app that was previously full screen now moves into two-thirds of the screen, and your slide-over app is currently active in one-third of the screen. So you've got a two-thirds, one-third split. And what you see there is you'll typically see the iPad app version in the two-thirds of the window and the iPhone version of the app that's in the one-third of the window. You can also drag that divider to the center of the screen to give it 50-50. And what you typically see there is two iPhone apps side by side. So if you have Safari in the main screen, when Safari's got two-thirds of the screen, you've got the back and forward buttons at the top and no footer bar. And then when you give Safari just half the screen, it basically turns into the iPhone Safari. So the which is a little bit weird because, you know, the interface like really rearranges itself to be narrower, but that's how it goes. So I'm really excited about that. I'm already completely addicted to it. I think it's an amazing enhancement, and the performance even in this first version is phenomenal. So I think it's going to be a massive, massive benefit over time for people. And I can see there'll be huge demand for apps to support this. You know, talking to kids in school about it, some who had watched the keynote and seen the demo, they were saying, you know, that's going to be amazing to be able to have a web page and pages up at the same time on their screen at once. So they're really looking forward to that.
Did read an article earlier today that developers can now block users from seeing their app in the App Store if it's a non-64-bit device.
Mm. Yeah, so although Apple's not going to cut off these older devices. Now, what is a non-64-bit device? Is that A5 and earlier?
I think so.
I think it's A5. It was the last 32-bit iOS device. Yeah, so clearly what's happening there is Apple are giving developers the option to cut off these users, but Apple themselves are not going to cut off these users from, say, iOS support in general, even though some of these features are requiring more hardware. It's kind of obvious why the iPad Air 2 is the only iPad that can do two up apps. It's because the iPad Air 2 is the only iPad to have 2 gigabytes of RAM and not just one. It's also the fastest in terms of its processor as well, but I think the RAM is actually the main reason why the split screen two apps at once feature is restricted to the iPad Air 2. I think the iPad Air 2 has also got an additional core, is that right?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, I think it's 3 cores. So it's obviously just they just described it as the most powerful iPad gets the most powerful feature. And I think at face value, it's just a hardware limitation for the other ones.
I think it's good timing considering your device. You'll be probably deploying the iPad Air 3 next year.
Yeah, we've got a refresh in summer 2016. So either we do the iPad Air 3 or I hope the iPad Air 2 becomes like last year's device. And so whether we even buy the newest one or the previous generation model, we still get all these features. I think that's going to be really cool.
Before we move on, let's thank our second sponsor of the night, the fine folks at Jamp Software. Jamp provides IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies, such as Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs in schools. A great app for teachers called Casper Focus that allows the teachers from their iPad to take control of their classroom experience. It allows teachers to quickly gain student attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select a specific Apple TV, choose and distribute iBooks, and even initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. Learn more about Casper Focus and the Casper Suite at jampsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com. We have a link to their website, the show notes at outofschool.net. This is episode 137. Thanks to Jamp for sponsoring the show.
Okay, so what else we got in terms of iPad enhancements?
iPad hardware keyboard enhancements, and I think, I really think we are going to see a wired keyboard for the iPad from Apple at some point.
Yeah, I can definitely see accessories coming, and I think quite possibly when we get a refresh of the iPad in the fall this year, I think we're going to see. It seems to me just so obvious right now that a bigger iPad is going to come. Because when you use some of these features, such as picture-in-picture video, it's great on a 9.7-inch iPad, but wherever you put the window, it's always in the way a little bit, So I think a larger iPad is obvious for that reason, but also because if you split a regular iPad 50-50, what happens is that both sides are iPhone class, right? Whereas I think the real power comes when you can have a full iPad app and an iPhone app, or two full iPad apps at the same time. So a little bit more horizontal space would allow the size class of each side to be bigger. And I think you would see, you would have the full iPad experience of two different iPad apps at once. And I think that's going to be really powerful. I don't know anything, obviously, but it seems to me really obvious that the iPad Pro is going to be a product in the future.
Yeah, it's like you can just see it. And it makes more sense. Like you could see where people might want it. It's almost like the people that buy the iPad Mini are just in a different group of people. They're going to want the Pro. Like you can almost see a world where the 10-inch iPad goes away and it's just the Mini and it's just the big one.
Could be. You never know. The other thing to say about the whole iPad feature enhancement thing is that you also got this new feature where you can, if you put two fingers on the keyboard, you can place and then highlight with the text insertion cursor. I've tried this. It's not the easiest thing to do right now, partly because there's no documentation to show you how to do it or what gesture does what thing. But basically, you can sort of you put two fingers, the keys fade away, and a little iBeam cursor starts tracking around the text area that's currently active based on where your fingers are and things. So it's essentially like a trackpad. It's the first kind of cursor-like control on an iPad that has not involved touching exactly where you want the cursor to go. which is how it's been since iOS 2. That's interesting, and it'll be interesting to see if that becomes a standard feature or something that people really take to doing. But I can see the utility of it, and certainly the speed of it as well.
Next thing, we get some enhancements to the Notes app. It's not, you know, the thing about the Notes app is it is moving to, like, the iCloud backend is no longer going to be synced via IMAP.
Yep.
It's a very basic version of Notability. And the one thing that scares me about Notes, like, because it kind of could do a lot more of what Evernote could do now outside of the organization. You can add in images, mm-hmm. you can add in checklists. In some ways, like, it's an Evernote killer. But do you, like, there's no versioning. There's no time machine in the cloud. So, like, if it all just disappears, what do you do?
Yeah, and it supports kind of attachments and things like that. You can sort of send things into Notes as well. It is, I think, it's a great enhancement to a very basic application. And, you know, I don't use Notes, and I'm going to guess you don't use Notes very much, Bradley, but plenty of other people do. You know, people who are not into Evernote, people who are not into Notability or other note-taking apps, you know, Notes does a job for them. And the fact that you can now sketch in it as well and things like that, and also add to it from the share sheet as well, I think it's a nice enhancement to an app that people genuinely use. I don't think there's no need to put it any more strongly than that. I mean, I don't think Evernote's got a ton to worry about just yet, because obviously it doesn't have a lot of that kind of notebook style organization. It's just a sort of searchable list of notes that you've got so far.
In fact, it may actually help Evernote if people start using Notes to using these new features, and then they decide they want more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's perfectly possible too. And I think it's kind of like podcasts, you know, podcast is good, Overcast is better, you know, and it helps. It helps people who make podcasts, which is great.
Right.
So now we're kind of looking into the operating system a little bit. There's a whole set of new extension points. You know, extensions were introduced in iOS 8, and we had extensions for things like, you know, photo editing and the share sheet and different stuff like that. But there's now other places where you can hook into the system and do your own thing. We've already mentioned the content blocking extension filter point for Safari. So that's specifically for Safari, the app. It can block stuff there. There are new extensions for app indexing. So there's a couple of different ways that Apple can index your app. And that kind of becomes interesting at the search thing we'll talk about in a second. There's also extension points for VPN. So you can now have apps that do special things with VPN if you have some particularly high security requirement, which I don't really think schools are going to be in that situation. And there's some additional extension points for filtering. And all it says so far that I've been able to read is a quote, to implement dynamic on-device network content filtering. So instead, like we said, instead of network filtering being at the network level, it's now at the device level. And it remains to be seen exactly how that's delivered and how it's controlled and how it's deployed. But we'll, you know, watch this space, and we'll come back on that one as soon as we know more.
Before we move on, let's thank our final sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Shobi. Now, Shobi is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, teachers can quickly and easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads, and then provide rich feedback to students. And students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of compatible iPad apps, or by completing assignments with Shobi's built-in tools. Shobi keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email, and push notifications. Shobi Basic is completely free, so if you want to get started with your classroom, you can today. If you want to try it out with all your students, or if you want to try it out with the entire school, you can do that. If you try it and like it, they have a great deal on Shobi Pro for out-of-school listeners. If you buy Shobi Pro for 5 teachers, they'll give you an extra 5 teachers for free for a year. So it's buy 5, get 5 free for a year. Go to shobi.com/out-of-school for details, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. So what's next?
So the other sort of big feature in iOS, really, apart from the stuff for iPad, is this whole idea of search, right? This idea that Siri is now your kind of proactive assistant that tries to give you information based on things that you've done in the past and so on. So I'm just looking at my iOS 9 app, and if you go into the search screen, which is now back to being the first screen before the home screen, one of the news stories it says is guide dog jumps in front of bus to save owner. So I'm not sure how that's super relevant to what I'm doing right now, but there you go. But in general, the idea is that apps are going to be like one of the ways in which iOS knows about the things you care about, right? So app developers can have their app and the content of their app indexed, and then that information shows up in Spotlight search. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, they're kind of, Apple's kind of using the fact that, you know, all these sites like, you know, hotels.com and Starbucks and the British Rail app and different things are all bringing data to the device. And this is all data that the user has already expressed some possible interest in because they've installed the app. And then there's also a way in which developers or companies can add markup to their website, and Apple will crawl the web and build a search engine for that as well. But primarily they're trying to get a kind of head start on this by indexing the apps that are already on the user's device. That's basically how this search stuff is going to work. Because it depends on apps, I slightly worry or wonder whether or not you're going to get a different experience on your iPad and your iPhone if you have different sets of apps installed. You know, that seems like a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, you know, Apple has content deals with specific providers, and those are all going to hook into search as well. So Yelp data and TripAdvisor and so on is all going to show up there for sure. But there is a small possibility of getting information from an app you haven't installed. So it will be possible, in principle, for you to search for something, I don't know, like, let's say, House of Cards, maybe. And if you don't have the Netflix app installed, Siri will actually offer, you know, would you like to install the Netflix app in order to satisfy your information query there? So it'll be a toss-up to see how annoying slash helpful that is, depending on, I mean, of course, gaming the App Store search engine optimization is going to be a massive industry, I'm sure. So we'll wait and see on that. But it could be good. It could be terrible, I think, is really...
The theory of it works. It's just how useful is it day to day?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we said last week, you know, Google do a great job of giving you hypothetically awesome cards in Google Now. So every Google Now demo is amazing because the ideas they have for cards are brilliant. However, Google Now only ever shows me the weather, right? And the 6-minute drive to work and back. So this is kind of the same thing. Is in principle, this is fantastic. In practice, will it be that good? I don't know. And, you know, I think more people kind of like the idea of Google Now. I mean, I love the idea of Google Now, that I actually get massive utility out of it. So this may not be as high a bar to clear as we all think it is for Apple to kind of compete with Google Now at the moment. But I kind of feel like the way that Google Now works is you kind of feel like they're pulling all that information from all over the world, and it feels really powerful and trustworthy to me for some reason, whereas the Apple stuff is actually doing a lot of that stuff in the background, like taking account of traffic conditions, but it's not so kind of fussy about it. It doesn't tell me about it. So I'm sort of like, well, is that going to be right? Or is that, you know, is it being smart or is it just being really crap? And it's hard to, sometimes hard to tell a difference. When you don't actually have all the information at your fingertips that the software used to make its decision.
Siri is either a genius or she's crazy.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, Siri swings wildly from day to day. So that's the search capabilities. In principle, it's a great idea. In practice, we just have to wait and see how it works.
Next up was the on-demand resources. And what this is like where, like, some of the materials for an app, let's say images or icons, that normally would be downloaded with the app can be kind of pushed on demand when you need them from the internet. Of course, you know, the thing will be here, the interesting thing will be like, you know, what if you need something and then you're offline at that point? Like, what if you're, you have a Wi-Fi on the iPad? Of course, you know, we'll see how that works.
Yeah, it's not clear to me exactly what's going to be the trigger for a download of a specific piece of content. I think there are some interesting implications for school networks. I think for one thing, you know, you're going to install an app quicker, which is great, right? The initial app install is going to go a lot faster. You know, like GarageBand is, I mean, GarageBand's a prime candidate for this kind of thing because you've got sort of probably 40 megs of actually, you know, app stuff, including images and help documents and stuff, and then you've got like hundreds of megabytes of just music. And if that stuff could be cached in the cloud and then download it whenever you want to actually listen to that loop, you know, that would be a huge win. Big question to my mind, though, is what's the, it makes the impact of App Store traffic on your network a lot less predictable, because not all of it will happen at once. And I think one scenario that, you know, we're always thinking of the doomsday scenario, but here's the doomsday scenario for on-demand resources. You're standing in front of a class of 32 kids. You're teaching them GarageBand for the first time so they know how to use it. You say, okay, let's have a look at the loop stuff. They all press the loop button at the same time. The loop browser opens and then immediately tries to download 500 megs of loop information from the cloud 32 times over your school network. So that's going to be very interesting to see whether or not that actually... first of all, whether it actually happens or not, is it smarter than that? And secondly, hopefully caching server can help with some of that stuff as well. So we'll just have to kind of get some more information about how that's all going to work together over time.
Yeah, I'm sure they've thought through a lot of these things. They make way more money than we do, so yeah. We shall see.
No, I'm sure that there have been thought about this over time. Last thing, Bradley, is there are better quality voices coming to iOS, which I think is great. It's really great for pupils with additional needs. We actually had some kids recently who were doing exams, and they were writing the exams themselves by hand, but they were using the iPad first and then later the Mac to read the question to them, and then they would answer the question on paper. It's one of possibly many configurations of additional support provision during an exam. But the reason they were using the Mac was because the Mac has got much higher quality voices available to it than iOS does at this point. So we found that it was easier for them to understand when they were listening to the high quality Mac voice. So it was good to see that better quality voices are coming to iOS as well. I don't know if they're exactly the same as the Mac ones, but they just have been described as better than the ones that are there right now.
Yeah, we always found it better.
Yeah, better is good. We'll take that. So, watchOS.
Time travel was that's nice. It's where you can kind of like go see like in the future, like what is the weather going to be like at 8 o'clock? What's the temperature going to be like? Where's my calendar look like at 8 o'clock? It's a neat little trick. Never thought about it. Time machine would have been a good name, but
that was already in use, I'm afraid. Yeah.
Third-party complications, I think that'll be great. I'm really, really excited to see what developers can come up with. I just hope it doesn't affect battery life too much and like how often it can update and things like that.
Yeah, I think there's some that's kind of under the control of the watch rather than the developer, although for certain kinds of high-priority information, the developer can say, hey, I need to update my complication right now. I personally think that third-party complications on the watch is probably the single most important thing that was announced in the whole keynote. I think that's really, really important because the watch faces are great right now in terms of what they can do for you, but there are other things I care about more than, you know, the time in New York or whatever. But I've got that on my watch. It's useful, but, you know, the weather, the temperature, I have it there because it fills up a space, but I would rather have, you know, how many things are still left to do today from OmniFocus, or, you know, the charge level in an electric car was a great example. I could use that as well if the Nissan Leaf app wasn't just the worst app on my entire phone. So I'm not super optimistic they're going to fix that, but maybe I'll buy a Volkswagen next time just to get a nicer watch app.
Why did you buy this car, sir? You have a good iPhone app and a good watch app.
Okay. Yeah, I made a £20,000 decision based on, you know, a free app in the App Store versus one that hasn't been updated in a while.
First, obviously, we're getting full apps native on the watch, and yeah, it's not like WatchKit apps will just look terrible. Well, none on the device WatchKit app. It's still WatchKit now, just the back end is happening directly on the watch.
Yeah, the APIs are the same or better. You know, they're enhanced version of the APIs, but what you can do in a watch app now and what you can do in a watch app in the future will be essentially similar things, but more performant and more reliable, which is, quite frankly, that's the biggest problem with the watch right now, is the apps are slow to operate or unreliable to even launch in the first place because communication with the phone is not as good as it could be.
I don't even watch third-party apps for the most part. It just takes too long. By the time the display times out, I can just get my phone out.
Yeah, yeah. That's an issue, and I think it's one that needs to be and will be addressed with watchOS 2.
Next was El Capitan, OS 10. It's a lot of little things here. Lots of minor enhancements to Mail, Safari. Again, nothing negative here. It's the symptom of a very mature operating system. This seems like it's going to be a lot of stability on the back end, we hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they had a few things like they've got some of that window management snapping stuff that kind of like their stuff in iOS, but you know, a little more freeform because it's OS 10, which will help people, I think. You know, this weird thing where when you shake the cursor gets bigger on the screen. Now, I don't shake my cursor to find out whether or not where the cursor is. I use it to find out whether or not the Mac is frozen. And if they can solve that problem, then maybe I don't need the cursor to get big. But yeah, El Capitan is going to be great. They spoke about enhancements and performance as the two kind of tentpole ideas. And I'll happily take that, no question about it.
Oh, yeah. I want my Mac. I like how my Mac works. Not a lot I want it to do, just work all the time. One thing I did read the other day is websites can now, on El Capitan, if it's a force-sensitive trackpad, they can interact with that.
That'll be interesting. I wonder if they can use that information to see whether or not you're clicking very angrily on their links or or very gently. That would be the new SEO metric, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally.
We click so hard.
So, you know, again, we're gonna gloss over the music stuff. It was long. Apple Music, go read about it on the web. The next thing, I guess, that was interesting to us was the what's new with managing Apple device session. That was session 301. That was Tuesday, correct?
Yep. Tuesday, 9 a.m. or something like that.
One of the things that they mentioned right off the gate was there's a special emphasis on shared deployments. Yep. And so I'm wondering if that's in response to Chrome OS.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I have no doubt that it probably is, because I bet you when Apple goes to schools and they say, hey, why don't you buy an iPad? They're going to say, well, we're looking at Chrome OS. And then the next question is, why are you looking at Chrome OS? And they're going to say, because we can share them. You know, and there were rumors that multi-user support was going to come to iOS in this version, at least for iPad. And that hasn't happened yet, but I have absolutely no doubt that it's going to happen.
I talked to a school this morning out in California. They have 2,900 students. All running shared Chromebook deployment, and the lady said, it's a public school. She said, we have no chance of ever being able to afford a 1-to-1. So, yep. Obviously, 1-to-1 is ideal, but there are times when it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So, device enrollment program is now in 26 countries, and they have the turnaround time for a broken device turned out to you can do it in 4 hours.
And that's the turnaround time for that device's UUID being enrolled in your DEP system, right? So if you get handed over a new one in the store, they have to put it in DEP for you for evidence reasons, I guess. That 4-hour turnaround time is going to be useful. I haven't experienced that personally, that problem, but yeah.
I can see where that would be completely annoying. But of course, I'm sure if you're going through that, 4 hours is still completely frustrating. You probably want it to be 4 minutes, but
yeah.
Obviously, it must be an improvement. Next thing, enrollment optimization. So what I gathered that this was doing, like when the device is getting the information from DEP and therefore pulling in the MDM configuration profiles over the air, the device stays in setup assist until all that's finished. So even if the user was kind of like going through that quickly, it doesn't let them under iOS 9.
Right. Okay. That I understood it a little bit differently. I think you're right and I'm wrong. But or maybe there's two parts to this. But one other part was that they described this as being it enabled you to go from plugging in the Lightning cable to basically getting to the home screen without any user interaction with the device at all.
We're both right. You're thinking of the end when they're talking about Configurator 2.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. This is DEP over the air updates. Like where, like, let's say, for example, I'm trying to think of an example. Let's say you had a configuration that turned off the App Store. Well, if you quickly got through the setup assistant before it got that configuration downloaded, you would see the App Store.
There's a window of opportunity there, isn't there?
Right. Yeah. It's very small, but yeah, again, nice little enhancement.
Yeah. Okay.
A couple things on, again, they kind of mixed and matched iOS and OS 10. Mm-hmm. You can basically limit like local accounts on OS 10, and it can go fully to networked accounts only on the device, or you can have DEP force the user to create a standard account, but then create a hidden administrator account in the background for the administrator to work with. So again, just small little workflows, nothing huge, nothing that's going to make it to the verge. But if you manage these devices, these are great enhancements.
Yeah. So I mean, this is stuff that, you know, it's everyday niggles for the administrator that are you know, there are solutions for these things, but they're kind of scripty and they're, you know, not totally supported. But and they require intervention, of course, right? And the point of DEP is not to have to intervene with the device at all. So, yeah, nice enhancements.
Next thing they covered was exactly what you said, Apple Configurator. And this is going to be Apple Configurator 2, which we'll talk about in a minute, can now take an iPad all the way to the home screen. So we've seen that, like, where depending on the update or depending on what you're doing, you may have to kind of click through the setup assistant, even if it's just bouncing and clicking the Wi-Fi, even though it has the passcode, just that kind of stuff. Now you can take it from the Lightning cable to the home screen, all from Apple Configurator.
No tap on the screen. Right, all you have to do is plug in the cable and hit the button in Configurator, and you will end up with a device on the home screen.
Next thing is new distribution tools for apps. Now, this is like the big one to a lot of schools. Now, this first one is not going to apply to schools. It's multinational app assignment. This is going to be big for businesses that operate across countries. Mm-hmm. It's where if you buy an app, it can be distributed to app stores of other countries as long as that app store sells that app.
Yeah.
Again, I had to watch that a second time to think through who needs mm-hmm. that, but it's businesses that operate in multiple countries.
Yeah, but this is actually really appropriate for one particular class of school, which is international schools. Because if you think about the problem that international schools have, there's two problems they have quite often. One is you've got students who have come from another country, and they've probably brought their iTunes account with them. Right. So if say I was to emigrate to Japan, right, and want to put my kids into British school in Japan, if I'm only going to be there a few years, they've got UK iTunes accounts, but the school's VPP account is in Japan, right? So So if they were to buy an app in the Japanese VPP store and try and assign it to me, hitherto this would not have worked because their account is not in the same country as the school's VPP account, you see? So this actually does have a relevance to schools who this might apply, you know, 10 different ways around the school because people coming from different countries. The other situation, which I know at least one school in this situation, schools that are on the border of two countries, particularly in Europe, this is a live and serious problem for them because I have a friend who teaches in a school in Geneva, and Geneva is really close to the border of France, the Swiss-French border. And quite often they would have in their school several children who live in France crossing the border every day to come to school in Switzerland. And those kids at home they had French registered credit cards, or the parents did. They had French Apple IDs, and the school was buying, at that time they were buying gift cards in Swiss francs and giving them to these kids who had French accounts, and they had a problem. Later on doing VPP and buying Swiss VPP apps and pushing them to French kids and things like that. So there are a couple of situations where that is actually really important for schools as well. Not as many as you might think, but you know there are some schools that do live in that kind of situation.
I didn't think about that. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Next up, this is the big daddy. Assigned managed distribution apps to devices without Apple IDs assigned to them. So it's assigning it to the device and not the user. So like, who is this huge for? It's huge for kiosk and shared deployments. So kiosks like museums, we mentioned like car dealerships, any place there's an iPad. Like, you know, it's like our target has iPads all throughout the store for registries. And I'm wondering how they did that. Obviously, they must have a user. I don't know how they were doing it, to be honest with you. But yeah, it's like those type of deployments. Now, a couple caveats about this. If a user is logged into the App Store, but the app is assigned to the device, the user will not see that app in their purchase history. So like a school may choose to do this even if their students have Apple IDs.
Mm-hmm. To me, that deployment scenario doesn't make a ton of sense, but it is technically possible. I think this is bigger for schools which are primarily or entirely serving populations of kids who are under 13. So in fact, your school, for example, Bradley.
Yes.
Right. Where what we have done over the past year when we adopted managed distribution was I went around and I created a device generic Apple ID for every device. So there's an Apple ID 1, Apple ID 2, Apple ID 3 at Cedars, and one of them is on every device. Right. It took me a long time, had to get whitelisted to do it, but I did get it done. So all of our devices do have a live Apple ID, and I needed that because in order to be able to assign apps to those devices, really, I had to actually assign them to fake users, right? So I was essentially doing a workaround for the fact that you could, when you're using managed distribution, you have to assign the app to a user, not to a device. And of course, if you think back to the tethered world of Apple Configurator and coupon codes, we were always assigning apps to devices in that world. So essentially what's happened is it's like a radical step forward back into the past, because what we're doing now is we're using our MDM server, we're doing managed distribution over the air, but we're doing it in a mode that we used to do all the time with Apple Configurator, which was apps are assigned to devices, not to users. And that was actually the big change 2 years ago with managed distribution, was now apps are assigned to users and not to devices.
Now we have both. Whatever situation works for you.
You're right. Now you can do either. And I think I will probably migrate back to doing this for the younger users, because there's literally no benefit to them almost at all to have an Apple ID whose password they do not know on their device. Because I control every app that's on their device anyway, so why bother with that complication?
Can you get those licenses back, I'm assuming? Yeah, I guess so, because you can just revoke them from that Apple ID and then reassign them to the device.
Yep, and that's still true. That's still true if you're doing device assignment rather than user assignment. You can assign to a device and revoke from a device in exactly the same way as you used to do with assigning to a user and revoking from a user.
Next thing they mentioned was need to purchase the app, an app per device. And that got like a lot of cheers, I think. And I didn't understand that, because you've had to do that for years anyways.
The rule at the moment is you need to buy one per user or one per device, whichever is fewer. Okay. So if you have, say, like some of our older kids have got their school iPad and a personal iPhone or a personal iPad, I only have to buy one license for that student. Because it's the number of users or the number of devices, whichever is fewer. So, you know, fourth year girl, she's got her own iPhone. I assign Keynote to her. She can also go and install that Keynote on her phone perfectly within the terms and conditions, because I've assigned it to her Apple ID and not to her iPad. Whereas if I was to change from that model to device assignment, when I assign a Keynote to her school iPad, she would not see it in her purchase history and she would not be able to install it on her personal device. I'm not sure why folk were cheering for that in the session, but I think that's a limitation, perhaps, in my opinion, for older kids. I would consider that more of a limitation than a benefit.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. I forgot about that scenario. Yeah. Now, here's the caveat. Developers apparently need to opt in to this device-based assignment.
Yeah.
And it's not available yet. It's something you've got to do in iTunes Connect. And so, like, what are you going to do if all of your apps don't support this?
I don't know, but I can't think of a reason why a developer would not support this. Why on earth would you not support it? I don't know. I don't know why they've made it optional, right?
Yeah, unless it's – and I think the reason it won't get supported is because someone wouldn't know about it or not understand what it is.
Yeah, sometimes with these things, they make this like an interstitial page when the developer next logs into iTunes Connect. I think the educational discount is like that as well. Developer sees, hey, here's a checkbox. Do you want to turn on the educational discount, yes or no? So hopefully they'll get most apps opted into it. But it will be a pain if one app you don't want – an app you do want to use is not involved in this, and your whole model depends on that being available for your apps. That will be annoying.
Now he did have a dig to MDM solutions pinging iTunes too often and said, hey, if you keep doing this, we may block your users from the app store. So I wonder who that is. It's probably some of those like free or just low budget MDMs that have not developed it properly.
It's Meraki, you know it is.
Oh, yeah. Last thing, install apps via MDM or Configurator, even if the App Store is disabled. So that'll be good.
Yeah, that is useful. I mean, Apple Configurator has been able to do that for a while, as long as Configurator itself disabled the Apple Store in the first place. But being able to disable that and still push new apps is really interesting. Now, a little technical detail here. Device assignment, the actual act of installing the app on the device under device assignment is now the responsibility of the MDM server, not of the App Store, right? So in previous times, when you assign an app to a user, the user has to then either have on the install new apps automatically setting in the store settings, or they have to install it from their purchase history. And that's because the MDM server can't send a command to the device to say, please install this app. Under device assignment, they do that now. So installing and updating, important, the app is all down to the MDM server. So your MDM server, and this is great actually, because what it means is that if a device misses a push for some reason, or it's not online when the assignment happens, typically the kids have to go and install it from the App Store. But now the MDM server can continually try and install the app until it gets a confirmation that it's been installed. So we have this problem quite a lot right now under managed distribution, where a teacher will come to me at 8 in the morning and they'll say, can I get this app for all my iPads? I'll go, yeah, I'll do it right now. Go into Casper, assign the app to all those Apple IDs. But of course, half the devices are not charged, or they're not turned on, or they're off the Wi-Fi. The app is assigned, but the device doesn't get the command from the App Store to push. And that command only seems to happen once. And if the device misses it, too bad. And then the teacher's got to go around, 8 out of 10 iPads or 15 out of 20 or something, and then manually install that app from the purchase tab. Whereas with device assignment, the MDM server should be able to, in principle, take care of that itself by sending install app commands until it gets confirmation that the app was successfully installed. So I think that's going to be a nice and important update. It depends how individual MDM vendors are going to implement that, but I certainly hope that's what's going to happen.
One of the things, I'm not sure where it was in the keynote, I think it was around here, not the keynote, but the session, was forced iOS updates.
Yes, this is another thing that I think is going to be really interesting, is that there's now an MDM command to force a device to stage the update, i.e. download it, and then I think, although I can't find any documentation of this right now, also install it. So we've been talking about this for a while, let's make sure people get up to date. This is going to be a thing we can do now. And I think it's going to be really useful for just rolling up point updates. I don't think there's functionality to hold back an update, but you can forcibly advance if you want to. And I've got a couple of people who I am going to use that command on next year for sure.
It would be nice to need to know how it works. Like, hey, okay, when this device has been idle for 10 minutes and it's plugged into Wi-Fi and charged, just do the update. Because one of the options I have on Chrome OS is to update automatically and force reboot. So it'll just randomly reboot. Obviously, I don't think when the user's working, but if it's not being used and there's an update, just reboot it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what kind of fine-grained control there is in that and how much there is.
The next thing is we've got some new restrictions. Mm-hmm. We just did our show on this and the configuration profile, so of course it's out of date automatically.
So we get to do another show on it, yeah. So there are new restrictions, and there are also some deprecated restrictions, which is kind of important. There is a document called the Configuration Profile Reference, which has not been updated yet with these new keys. So we'll report back when we get a look at all the new keys that are valid for iOS 9. But some are mentioned in the session. One is screen recording, right? Which I hadn't even clicked was a feature of iOS 9. But I think it's built into one of the gaming APIs, where basically it's about generating video to post on Twitch or whatever, right? There is a way to disable that, and perhaps that also disables it by the, when you plug into your Yosemite Mac, you can record the screen through QuickTime Player. Maybe that disables that as well. We've got automatic app downloads. That's a control, so you can sort of force that setting on or off for supervised devices, which is great. Disable iCloud Photo Library if you want to. There was mention of a restriction about keyboard shortcuts. I couldn't interpret what that meant yet, so we'll come back to that when we know about it. And then, Bradley, I know you were quite keen on this one, that you can prevent modifying the device name, prevent setting a passcode on the device, and prevent changing the wallpaper on the device. That's that emphasis on shared deployments, isn't it?
Yes, yes. The wallpaper is the biggest one. The passcode will just save you some trouble later. That again goes along with not having to touch the device.
Yeah, yeah. Casper can already enforce a device name, but I think what they're doing right now is they've just built some functionality around an MDM server's ability to set the device name. And what will happen is if a user can still change it, but then Casper will set it back to the setting that you said it should be.
This will be blocking it.
Yeah. This actually disables the ability of the user to edit the name on the device at all. And I think that's really useful for like AirDrop now, because that device name is what shows up in AirDrop. And we've got some devices where kids have they've changed the name of the device to all emoji watermelons or something like that. And it's like, who's the watermelons, And it's that kind of thing. So
I heard someone say today that is it possible that the Egyptians had emoji and that once they had it, that's all that was left? And that's why we have hieroglyphics.
That's really weird, because I was teaching about Unicode the other day and somebody mentioned hieroglyphics and emoji in that exact same context. That's weird. It's a great question, though, because, one of the things that you don't often talk about with Unicode is, what about ancient languages? Can we represent ancient languages? Can we represent languages that we haven't written down yet? These are all good questions for a computer science lesson. What else we got in restrictions? There are deprecated restrictions, okay? And what they mean by deprecated is not that they're going away, but that these restrictions are going to become supervised only. Now, this is not in iOS 9, but in the future, these restrictions will require supervision. And the way it was described was that these were restrictions that were made available before supervision was a thing, and they should always have been supervised-only restrictions. These are some pretty commonly used restrictions that are going to have to require supervision in the future. So they are restricting app installation, restricting app removal, disabling FaceTime. Disabling iMessage is already a supervised-only feature.
Yes.
So disabling FaceTime is getting that same treatment. Disabling Safari, which is something a lot of schools do, is going to require supervision. Disabling the iTunes store, restricting explicit content, and then iCloud documents and data, multiplayer gaming, and Game Center friends. Those are all going to be supervised only restrictions, probably in iOS 10 or so. And so that's just something to be aware of over time, that if you have staked the farm on being able to disable Safari, in time you're going to have supervised devices in order to continue doing that.
Well, that'll affect our friends at Kirby, because one of the things you can do with that app is you can say block, turn off the App Store, turn off Safari, and mm-hmm. you ideally won't be able to do that anymore unless the device is supervised.
Yeah, and very unlikely that home users are going to be supervising devices, in fact. Home users should stay well away from Apple Configurator, to be honest.
Last thing they covered, now they did a lot of demos using mm-hmm. Profile Manager, and we kind of joked that Profile Manager is really only useful for demos. I'm not kidding. It's fine.
That's harsh.
So Apple Configurator 2 is a mm-hmm. ground-up rewrite. It does look good. It's device-oriented and task-oriented. Mm-hmm. So there is some new. You can use Automator. You can do command line stuff with it. Mm-hmm. It has moved away from a single database mode. So you can back up these. You could store the file in iCloud or on a server, mm-hmm. and multiple computers could access the same configurator database. It also doesn't need iTunes any longer. So you can download apps, update apps outside of iTunes. So that'll be good.
Yep.
My thoughts here, this is all great. And I tried to think through today, who is Apple Configurator for? Mm-hmm. Because to me, if you're buying 50 or more devices, you need just to have the MDM. You just got to roll that into the price. You can lease it from Apple. That's what we'll do next year. We'll roll in our lease with Jamf for 3 years with our devices. Mm-hmm. So I think Apple Configurator is for the smaller deployments, maybe 25 and under, where it's really simple, it's really quick, and it's free.
Mm-hmm. And you're probably not changing them that much, right?
And to me, in my opinion, because again, especially once DEP is everywhere, to me, in my opinion, Apple would be better off to make a hosted version of Configurator, maybe a poor man's MDM. Maybe it doesn't have all the features. Maybe mm-hmm. it is like Apple Configurator online. I don't know.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I can still see a number of roles for Configurator in situations where, let's say it's a bring your own device deployment, right? And nobody's got an email account and, whatever. You maybe want to put, a root certificate in so you can continue to do network filtering in the face of SSL, let's say. Having kids come into the service bay you know, you plug their device into your Apple configurator and you do this one task to every device, which is put a particular profile on it, okay? You're going to be glad that configurator exists in that situation.
That's true.
I'm thinking about another scenario for myself, which is when we do a refresh, one of the things I like to do is when we get the new devices in, I want to set them up with basically no settings on them and just make sure that all the physical hardware works, the camera, the volume buttons, the on-off button, the home button, and so on. And being able to plug them into configurator, you know, 7 or 10 at a time, and just with no clicks on the device, go from nothing to the device is configured and ready to interact with and on the Wi-Fi. Even though I'm going to have DEP at that point, I'll still use that because it's a quick way to get up and running to just do a physical test of the hardware, and then I'll reset them again and set them up properly through DEP when the kids come in, just because to check the camera works and things like that. So things like that. And I also hope, this is my real hope, is that this new sort of quote-unquote task-oriented approach to Apple Configurator means that I can plug in an iPad and do one thing to it. And the example, the classic example, you know, over my couple of years using managed distribution is a device has got a cracked screen. I want to make a fast backup of it and I want to do a fast restore. Now, at the moment, the only way I can do that is through iCloud, and it's neither fast nor reliable. So it would be great if I could, a kid could bring in their device, say, oh, I've broken my iPad. I can plug in a cable, suck their configuration off into a backup file, plug in another one, restore to that device, and then go back and the kids can just continue working with that device as if it wasn't, as if it had never been touched with the configurator. I really hope that's possible with this. I haven't tried it yet, but I certainly hope it's.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. The beta is out now if you're a registered developer, and that'll be all be out in the fall.
Yep. The beta does require El Capitan, worth mentioning, which is why I haven't used it yet, because I've only got this one Mac and I'm not installing El Cap on it just yet.
I don't even know that I'm going to – I don't know. We were talking about this earlier this morning in talking about maybe the schedule of this makes sense because they release this stuff in the fall, and by the time we go to deploy it next summer, it's really mature and it's bug-free.
Yeah, I mean, the final version of all this stuff is not going to be out until after we all go back to school. So this is really for, you know, session 2015, 16, isn't it? No, 16, 17.
16, 17, really. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and I don't plan to try and change my deployment model until we get our new hardware in 2016. At which point, yeah, we're going to adopt DEP. Yes, for the younger users, we'll probably move to device assignments. For the older users, I think we will keep doing what we're doing with individual Apple IDs for the older kids, because that has its benefits too. The kids can install additional apps that they want to use and so on. So I think it's a positive story for deployment from WWDC. I think a lot of these new programs and things are going to help schools with some of these edge cases and corner cases, and of course the shared deployment stuff is going to be helpful. And if the rumors are true that iOS is going to get multi-user support in the future, that, you know, closes a lot of reasons to not buy iOS.
Sounds like a great place to end it.
Yeah, let's leave it there.
Good show. Lots of exciting stuff. Thanks for listening, everybody. Would like to take a moment. If you haven't left us a review on iTunes, we'd appreciate that. It's itunes.com/out of school. I am Bradley Chambers on Twitter and chambersdaily.com on the web.
And I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web.